Work-life balance is a myth. If you want to be an entrepreneur, it's a myth. Networking is not working.
Ben Ling, the founder and managing partner at Bling Capital, an early-stage technology-focused venture capital firm. Ben has invested in 18 unicorn companies, including Lyft, Square, Airtable, and Rippling.
We're playing the multiple game and not the AUM game. And in terms of competing, we almost never lose.
Early first-time investors are like, I would really love some tips.
First-time founders, we call them undiscovered gems. And you pick up the rock and you say, is this a rock or is this a gem? And if you believe it to be a gem, then you want to buy it at a low price. If you don't have a highly differentiated value proposition, you got to be likable.
What are some words of wisdom you want to impart to me?
You miss 100% of the things you never see. You can't have everything in life. You have to make decisions.
What do you think separates the 1% from the 0.1% of investors?
People do not like my answer on that.
What is up, guys? Welcome back to the World Class Podcast. Today, I sit down with Ben Ling, the founder and managing partner at Bling Capital, which is an early stage technology focused venture capital firm. Ben has invested in 18 unicorn companies, including Lyft, Square, Airtable, and Rippling. Just recently, he was in the Forbes Midas list top investors as the number 5 seed investor in 2024. Prior to that, he was a managing partner at Kosla Ventures and held senior operating roles at Google, YouTube, and Facebook. And in this conversation, we dive into how Ben processes deals, his best advice on how to stand out in a competitive landscape, and exactly how to become a 0.01% investor. So without further ado, let's dive in. All right, Ben, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
I'm excited, man. I don't know if you saw this, but the Forbes list just came out. Top investors, 2023. Your name was on it.
2024, yeah.
That was a 2024 and came out already. All right.
Yes.
So you were, I mean, number 4 on the list. Super impressive. You got into venture, what, 10 years ago?
Yeah, roughly, actually.
10 years ago.
2013, I think, yeah.
If I had talked to you in 2013 and said you're going to be one of the top early investors in the world, would you have anticipated that?
I aspire to be. But you never know anything for certain.
What do you have to do to earn a spot like that? Like, what do they measure those off of? Is it based on fund returns, on how many unicorns you've invested in? Like, what did you have to do to earn that accolade?
So I think Forbes publishes the methodology, and it has to do with the number of investments that you made at the seed stage that have achieved a certain markup or a certain exit, and they heavily weight toward exits.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's what, there's some methodology, but I don't know it exactly.
So you've been in it for 10 years. You've had how many unicorn billion-dollar investments now?
I think around 18.
18.
Yeah.
Not bad. Yeah. It's a pretty good stat so far. Before we dive into, I want to pick your brain on, you know, what your edge is and all that good stuff. But why did you even get into investing? Because you were operating at like Google, Facebook, had an awesome operating career at some of the best tech companies. Like, what was the inspiration to even dive into investing?
Well, initially it was really just investing in friends' companies and keeping in touch with the next generation of entrepreneurs. So I was at Google and then at Facebook, and I ran Facebook platform. And there I was investing in a lot of friends' companies. And initially it was really not about returns. It was really not about becoming a venture investor. It was just about helping the next generation of entrepreneurs and keeping in touch with the next generation of entrepreneurs. Over time, it turned out to be, so in that era, there were very few angel investors. Unlike now, I think there's a lot more. In that era, there are fewer angel investors. And so I think, you know, there was Keith, Marissa, Jeremy Stoppelman. There was obviously a fair number, but there was not nearly, it's like an order of magnitude smaller list, I think, than it is now. And so over time, I think I developed a reputation of being helpful in terms of being somewhat of an insurance policy. If you need to get in touch with the head of Gmail, I probably knew that person. If you need to get the head of, you know, Facebook pages, I probably knew that person. You know, if your YouTube account had troubles, I probably knew that person, et cetera, et cetera. And so that initially was the key value proposition that I was offering, which is I was a good, you know, I was a skilled operator, but then also kind of had the network within the industry. But over time, I developed a reputation of being an angel investor, and, you know, I was investing personally for about 6.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I invested in about 80 companies before joining Kosla Ventures. So I was kind of lucky in the sense that I got my own, the ability to invest in whatever I wanted. And then I could make my own mistakes and learn my own lessons. So without the purview of venture fund and like any sort of politics, so on and so forth.
It's interesting to look at sequences in careers, right? Yeah. Like you had 6.5 years investing while you were an operator to make your mistakes, learn your lessons, build up some sort of track record, which then earned you the spot at Kosla. And then I think after a successful run there for over 5 years, then you're like, I can do this on my own now. What was that inflection point? Like, talk to me about when you were at Kosla for those 5 years, like cutting your teeth. How is that different than when you were angel investing on yourself? And what were the key things you learned there that kind of laid down the foundation to do this successfully at Bling?
So I think there's two or three things that are very different at a multi-stage venture firm than as an angel. The first is the ownership requirements that most venture firms have. And so typically most venture firms will target 10, 15, 20% ownership. You choose it depending on the fund size. And so that is a very different dynamic than being an angel, where you could be one of 20, or you could squeeze in at the last minute and say, hey, I want a 50K or 100K check. Typically in the venture setting, there's only one lead. And so you have to be a lot more aggressive in terms of the approach. And then you also have to have a strategy to win. So that's number one. So venture firms tend to be mutually exclusive with other venture firms, whereas angels are not mutually exclusive with basically anyone.
That's a good point.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is that at a venture firm, a larger venture firm like Kosla Ventures, there's many decision makers. And the decision making is a little trickier because you have the balance of what you want to invest in versus what the firm is known for, which may be different and may not be that like anywhere near the same thing, versus your judgment of the companies versus your partner's judgments of the companies. And so it's a tricky balance because there's a little bit, you know, the best firms I believe have very few politics, but by definition, when you have a lot of people involved, there's always some degree of convincing and, you know, winning others over. And it's often said that the best investments or the best returning investments are highly controversial at the early stages because there's non-consensus. And so it's tricky at a multi-stage firm when you have to decide, do I pound the table for this specific investment?
Yeah.
Because like, it, you know, nobody else seems to like it. Or do I just, you know, put this one away and then fight for another one?
Yeah.
And so that's a little bit tricky.
That's such an interesting, I don't know if it's a paradox, but like, because part of being a great investor is you have to be contrarian and you have to be right, right? That's Peter Thiel, Keith always talks about that. At the same time, a lot of the best founders, you have every top VC fighting for space on that cap table, right? And so what is a better signal? Do you fight for the deals that every VC is going after because it's prolific founders and everyone wants to invest in them? Or do you focus more on the deals that people are overlooking because you see something others don't? Like, is there a formula there or any insights on that?
I think there is a formula there, actually. So at Bling, we take a dual-pronged approach. Approach one is we look at first-time founders and evaluate them for their raw talent. Are they high IQ? Are they high EQ? Are they mentally tough and resilient? Are they stubborn, but not too stubborn to take good feedback when they hear it? Do they, you know, work crazy hours and, you know, will do anything to run through walls? So that's, you know, the first-time founder sort of mentality. And so we look at probably, you know, 20 to 30 investments every week. And we evaluate founders on these different dimensions. And so first-time founders, obviously, what I call them are they, we call them undiscovered gems. And the way that I describe what we do at Bling to our LPs is that our job is to every week, every month, go through piles and piles and piles of rocks. And you pick up the rock and you say, is this a rock or is this a gem? And if you believe it to be a gem, then you want to buy it at, you know, a low price. You want to buy it at a rock price because everybody else thinks it's a rock. You think it's a gem.
I love that metaphor. Okay?
And then you're going to spend the next 12, 18 months working with them to reveal their potential, because it's not us that are, it's actually, they are originally already gems, right? And then, so then at the Series A, Series B, so on and so forth, they get their markups and then they go on to the next accountable investor. So the dual prong approach is one, like on the first time founders, there's obviously another branch, which is like the second time founders, third time founders, Max Levchin starting another company, like say, Max, please, like, can we put in $2, $3 million? You set the terms, just give us our allocation, right? Clearly we do not have any sort of pricing power as a seed fund. And so we're just lucky to be along for the ride.
Right.
And so we need to be, you know, I think we need to develop our reputation. I think we've developed our reputation as being extremely thoughtful partners and good partners to founders.
Yeah.
And so for the second time founders or people that are known or famous, everyone's chasing them. Yeah. And it's because typically the recruiting risk, the operating risk, so on and so forth is de-risked. The product market fit risk is never de-risked.
Never de-risked.
Right?
You're right.
It's never de-risked. But you're basically saying this person knows how to operate. They know how to fundraise. They know how to recruit. They know how to do everything. So they're getting forward credit. They're getting a lot of forward credit. And I'm lucky to be part of that because, they could probably fund it themselves.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely.
So that's the dual, it's kind of the dual.
That's an interesting approach. When you're a young gun, now you've built a remarkable track record, right? People know you. When you're younger, starting Bling or maybe at Kosla, and you're fighting for that spot on the cap table against, seasoned partners at Sequoia and Index and all that. Like, what is your approach to winning that space on the cap table and having them select you? Like, how do you, especially for these unproven investors or early investors out there wanting to learn from someone who's done it, how do you win over those founders that really can have their pick of the litter?
Well, I think the answer is really depends.
Yeah.
I think part of venture is understanding the entrepreneur and what they are looking for and what they are seeking and whether you are in fact a good fit for that specific entrepreneur. Mm. So I think that obviously every firm has their own approach or their value proposition. For example, ours is around product and product market fit, helping companies find it, helping them scale. We have over 100 LPs who are the heads of product, heads of growth, heads of engineering, heads of sales, CEOs who are all invested in the fund. So when the funds invest in the company, all of them are invested in the company as well. And the company gets direct access to them for help, mentorship, and advisorship. So that's one of our value propositions. And then two is, our network is very broad. Typically, we can get to anybody in the industry within one or two hops. And the third is we really help with any of the strategy, operations, fundraising, et cetera, et cetera. And I think for first-time founders, it's especially helpful. Even the best founders, I think, do better with accountability. And also, fundraising is selling to a different customer. So typically, first-time founders, they may be great with their real customer base, but another customer base is the investor customer base. And typically we understand that market pretty well, having been at multi-stage firms, having been, having lots of friends in the multi-stage firms of how it is that, how do you pitch to a Series A firm? Like, who do you contact? Like, do you contact the top or do you contact, somebody senior, but not the top, et cetera, right? Mm-hmm. I think there's a variety of different things in how you run that process. So that's kind of how I think about it. And in terms of competing, we almost never lose. We're pretty price disciplined. So the cases where we typically lose is we will usually opt out because we think that the price is just too high. So for example, if there's a seed stage founder and they're raising, 5 or 10 million at 50 posts, that's not really not for us unless they're a proven successful founder from before. Mm-hmm. It just really doesn't fit our model. Typically we will invest, somewhere between 400K to a million for about 10 to 12%. We're really in that sweet spot in terms of the first time founder, from a pre-seed or a seed. We obviously can be flexible and stretch up. But that's kind of our sweet spot. So there's cases where we just we can't really compete because we're just not equipped to do so.
Right.
But generally I think that, we also take a very collaborative approach because we typically target, 10, 12, 15%. So sometimes 15%, but usually we can back off to 10 if needed.
Yeah.
So then that we can just share and work with partners because we typically think that it's better to have more accountable partners who are, who do real work around the table than to just be greedy on their own ownership.
Absolutely. What are the main asset classes you guys are involved in? I know you don't do certain asset classes, right? Like I believe you don't touch crypto or deep tech or hardware. What are the main asset classes you guys focus on?
We're really broad. We typically will do anything that you consider like the traditional internet technology.
Consumer, SaaS, AI.
Consumer,
AI.
Internet, mobile, SaaS, mm-hmm. AI. Marketplace, data, fintech, so on and so forth. Yeah, we don't do crypto. We've never done crypto. We don't do AR, VR. We don't do rockets. We don't do biotech. Yeah. We don't do those things because we're not experts at
that. You're not experts. You don't have an edge there. And you have an operating edge at these companies, so you know what works. Like you got to pick a lane and figure out what your edge is, right?
Right. We're not qualified to invest in those spaces.
Yeah, that's smart. You guys have raised, what, about 770 million assets under management now in that ballpark? I'm curious, what is the ultimate vision for success for Bling? Like in certain firms, you know, you might say it's, we want to get to a certain assets under management. We want to produce certain returns. But when you think about the ultimate success for the firm, like what comes to mind?
I think it's really straightforward. I think we're doing it. I think it's one, delivering a lot of value to the CEOs and helping them along their path.
Yeah.
And for them to say, you know, we're really happy that we chose them as a partner and our path is better as a result. They've changed the trajectory of the company in a positive way. So that's number one. And then number two is delivering good returns to our LPs. I think that's, you know,
it's that simple.
Yeah, it's that simple.
Because I think like, you know, when we look at success and like I look at this too, like I run a recruiting company, we onboard probably 200 startups a year. And, you know, I want to take it to 1,000 a year, right? Where we're serving 1,000 founders, turning them into raving fans. Mm. And we have success measured. Like we all want to have impact at such scale. But I'm like, is there an inflection point where you raise too much capital, which forces you to make worse decisions and it's worse for your LPs and you can't service the founders the same way, right? So what's the, what is the ideal fund size where it's actually maximal for the LPs and for your founders?
Well, it depends on who you are.
Yeah.
And for us as a seed fund, we kind of think that we're kind of at the limit there. We're at about $130 million for the seed fund, $130 million for the opportunities funds. And so I think we're kind of at that limit of, this is the fund size where we can stay collaborative, stay small. And I think that's our vision for the firm.
Yeah.
We don't have aspirations to raise multiple billions of dollars. I think that's a different game. It's like there's different games that the VCs play. And I think we're playing the multiple game and not the AUM game.
Right.
So we're playing the small fund type of game. And so, you know, we're trying to stay small.
I like that better. I think,
they both
can
work.
They both work, right? You have, I mean, Andreessen, Insight. I mean, a lot of funds have done incredible jobs. Really, I think you got to know yourself. But yeah, I think the quality of your work is the most important. Like whatever inflection point that reaches where that's the ceiling, it's like just focus on the quality, diluting it at the price of growth at all costs. It's tough.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, we talked about some founding principles of what it means to be a good investor, right? We got to be contrarian. We got to see things that the people aren't seeing. You have a special knowledge in a particular industry. So you have a kind of an unfair advantage in seeing the trends of where things are going. But I think it can be a little bit esoteric, right? People are like, what does that mean? Like, I got to be thinking about contrarian ideas. Like, would you be able to give an example of like one of your contrarian investments? And like, what did you see? What was your thought process that ultimately led you writing the check where others didn't?
Sure. So from Fund One, we have a company called VHO. And what they do is they do last mile delivery. And it's, think of it as they compete directly against FedEx and UPS. When we invested, so the founders are really great, Itamar and Fred. And the way that the company operates is that if I'm a driver, I bring my own car, I bring my station wagon, VHO gives me a route. I drive that route during the day and then I get paid for that route. So for drivers, it's a much better experience because you have wage predictability and schedule predictability, right? Versus like Uber and DoorDash, where maybe you'll get a job, maybe you won't get a job. And for consumers, it's just a much better, it's an experience built, you know, in this era, not built in like 1980. Mm. So you have a much better delivery experience where consumers can communicate. There's proof of delivery, et cetera, et cetera. And so for brands, it's also much better because if you think about it, it's very straightforward. As a consumer, if you're buying something from a brand online and your first experience is a disaster, what is the probability that you're going to repeat purchase? Like basically zero, right? But if you have a flawless delivery experience, what's the probability that you will repeat purchase? It's versus the failed delivery. It's going to be like much, much higher, right? Mm. So we thought that was like very, very, like to me, that's kind of obvious. And they were operating at pretty small scale, I think roughly around $1 million in revenue run rate. And we had been investors in Instacart and DoorDash and Lyft. So, you know, I thought that the same business model should work, right? But I think they actually pitched quite a few funds. And if you talk to the founder, he'll say he talked to quite a few people. But we believed that they could achieve density and scale, because with density and scale, you get better unit economics, you get better pay for the driver, so on and so forth. Like, it just kind of, it's the same play, right? So, and that company is doing, went on to raise, you know, a couple hundred million from General Catalyst, from SoftBank, and is doing a lot in revenue now. I don't know if the company's disclosed, but like orders of magnitude more revenue, and doing quite well.
I love that. So, were there any deals you missed that still haunt you?
I don't know that haunt is the right word, but obviously there are investments that, you know, one could have made. Like, for example, when I first saw Uber, I was like, this is like a black car service. So, like, you know, it's not very, and also I don't drink. So I was always the DD. And so I never,
like, I don't get it.
I never experienced like the pain of getting a car, because I was always driving. Right. So, and so that's an example where it was like, you know, in retrospect, probably should have invested, but like, you know, didn't.
Yeah.
But I think that's the nature of this business. You can't win them all. You can't catch them all.
How do you process lost offers? Like, maybe it's not as, maybe it doesn't sting as bad now that you've had a lot of success, but when you're earlier on, you miss that big deal. You're like, shit, man, like that could have been my ticket.
Yeah.
Have you always just been neutral? Like, this is the game and I'm just going to be even keeled about shit? Or like, how do you have to be? That's just the game.
You have to be. No one can catch them all. By definition, nobody sees all the companies. And so it's an unreasonable expectation.
Do you do post-mortems on all those? Like, hey, what did I miss?
Yeah, sometimes. But I mean, the basic thing is like, you miss 100% of the things you never see.
That's true.
And so like, by definition, like, you're not going to see them all. So it's like, it's okay. So it's also different at seed, because at seed, it's pretty hard to see everything. At the Series B, I feel like it's possible to see everything.
Right. You have a lot more data to look at.
Well, no, because the Series A rounds have been disclosed. At C, they're just being born. So like, you got to go find those babies. But like, if they all enrolled in middle school, then you can go to all the middle schools and find out who all the, you can find the roster and you'd be like, okay, here are all the companies. So let's go track them. So at least you see them.
Yes. Yes.
So at the early stages, I don't think it's possible to see everybody.
They're not on Crunchbase yet or PitchBook. Yeah. they're not in the system.
There's a ton of examples where we have a proprietary advantage, and you know, most firms have proprietary advantage of, you know, this company that we back that's doing quite well, and we think has, you know, high hiring bar for talent. You know, two of their engineers just popped out to build a new company, and we are the only fund they're talking to because we were their lead investors for that company. So. But every firm has that set of like, you know, proprietary advantages.
Yeah.
And I don't think seed funds by definition can see all the companies. So I don't think, you know, I don't think that there's an aspect of haunting or like being upset about it. I think like for us, we need to just do a really good job of evaluating, like making sure that our opportunity set is as wide as possible. The aperture is as wide as possible in terms of like, you know, the opportunities.
Yeah.
And then making sure that we evaluate them properly with respect and quickly. And then we make our decisions and, you know, do our best to be value-add partners.
Mm. There's so many questions you can't ask, right? Like, assessing is really hard. There's so many data points and some of them more meaningful.
What questions do you think you can't ask?
Like, what's that?
What questions do you think you can't ask?
I mean, you can get an understanding of like what market they're building in. Yeah. What their vision is. Yeah. Is it directionally correct? Yeah. Do they understand that? You can get an understanding of their character traits, I think, by assessing their past and their history, looking for points of like resilience where they figured out really hard problems. Right. Like, I know Alexander Wang is like, what's the hardest thing you ever worked on, or what's the hardest thing you ever gone through?
Yeah.
Those can be good signals, but it's so hard.
You mean that you, like, if you, even if you asked, you can't get a good answer.
Yeah. It's just so hard to assess. That's like, true. Which founder has really got the sauce, right? Like, are there any interesting questions or data points that you guys look at you think other people might be missing or under indexing on when you're assessing talent? I'm curious, like, what are the strongest signals that give you guys the greatest clue into whether or not this person or this team's going to pull it off?
There's many, many different signals that we look at. The first set is, are they high IQ, EQ? So I talked about this earlier. And part of this is their ability to communicate concepts clearly and simply? Are they able to understand questions that are being asked and to be able to answer those questions in a clear and concise manner? Or are they confused and start talking about other topics? Simple example. What are we having for dinner? Answer. Pizza. That's one example of an answer. The other example of an answer is, well, I went to the grocery store. I had to park, you know, at the second floor. And then I walked around the grocery store. And then I looked down like aisle 7. And then I thought to myself, should I buy potatoes? Right. So yeah. these are very different answers already.
Yes.
So there's a high IQ EQ. There's the mental toughness and resilience. And there's an aspect of challenging entrepreneurs in their pitch on certain topics where they are either, they could be right or they might be wrong, and just watching how they react.
Mm.
So some of them will, and so we look for entrepreneurs that can handle those questions.
Right.
Handle them well and professionally if they're right or if they're wrong, if that makes sense. So what that looks like is that they've got to be able to catch the question and say, okay, here's what I heard. Is that right? And then say, well, this is, you know, how we think about it, feedback, welcome, right? And so part of it is we will push on certain topics just to see how entrepreneurs react. And I think most investors do exactly this. So, you know, when I was interviewing at Google, I used to have this famous interview question. I would ask this revolver question. It's kind of like people think it's a Monty Hall question, but it's not. And I would ask the question, and then at the end of it, I would ask, like, they would come up with their analysis, and I would like stare at them and I'd say, Chris, are you sure? Like that. And I would not say anything after that. And the best candidates would always be like, you know what? I think so, but like, given that you're asking me this question, let me just take a quick look. And they go, okay. And they come back and say, you know, I am sure. Like, here's why. But the unfortunate thing is when I did that, maybe about 30% of the candidates that actually got the question right, they would say, no, I got it wrong. I got it wrong. And they're like, it's the other one.
Interesting.
And I'd be like, well, I didn't say you were wrong. I just asked if you were sure.
Mm.
And so I think there's an aspect of like, are they looking to like, just try to read you? Because that's not what great entrepreneurs have to figure out their own markets. They got to figure out like, you know, what the customers want, what like, so on and so forth. It's not like you read one person, you kind of just do what they say. And so there's an aspect that we do in that too, in evaluating entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
And then we also do references when we can.
Yeah.
So a lot of them, we can't really do references because like they may be just coming right out of school.
Yeah, talk to their teacher. It's like.
But yeah. But we try to do references when we can. If they have prior work experience, just to evaluate their work ethic.
Yeah, references are underrated.
Integrity.
Yeah.
So on and so forth. So those are some of the things that are a little bit harder to read in a meeting, but you can also, you know, reference.
I mean, 18 unicorns, you clearly see a lot of patterns, right? When you're looking at these founders, were there any that like really jump out or like across all these investments, this was true about these companies, these founders that can then lend itself to you for future investment decisions?
Yeah. It's all the stuff that I talked about.
All that same stuff. It's just like,
yeah, it's like that. They got to be high IQ EQ. They have to be mentally tough and resilient.
Yeah.
They got to be stubborn, not too stubborn.
Yeah.
Like they have to be stubborn enough to stay on track, but not so stubborn. They can't take good feedback when they hear it.
Yeah. I have a random question for you. I'm really curious your thoughts on this. You have two scenarios, right? One case, you have a founder that has a ton of support. People believe in them.
Yep.
They're like, you have this. You're so smart.
Yep.
They've got the world at their back, right? Mm-hmm. Another scenario is the founder, nobody believes in them. You can't do this. You can't pull this off. They have no support. They feel completely isolated. One of them wants to prove themselves and the world right. The other one wants to prove themselves, like other people wrong.
Yeah.
Who wins? Like, what's a greater predictor of success?
It depends. It depends on who this person is.
Uh-huh.
So when Parker was raising money for Rippling, it was controversial.
Uh-huh. I remember that.
And people like, you know, Keith and I were clearly set on investing with Parker again. I had invested in Zenefits. I had seen how hard Parker worked.
Yeah.
And it was controversial at the time because, you know, he had left Zenefits And you know, a lot of people had unkind things to say. And to me, I felt like Parker is this high IQ, mentally tough and resilient, like the guy that's going to run through walls and a chip on his shoulder. And so I was like, this guy is going and founder market fit, because he understood the market very, very well.
Extraordinarily well, yeah.
So I was like, okay, well, you know, I think this is like the perfect formula.
Yeah.
And so far, you know, so far, I think he's doing a tremendous job. So
incredible job. Yeah. What are they at now? They're raised their Series C or D, the Decacorn, $11 billion company. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we worked with them at the Series A level when they were early. But incredible. But
that was, so it depends. But some people can have a chip on their shoulder and go nowhere. It depends.
Really depends, huh?
It really depends, obviously, right? There's no single formula. If it were so easy, then it would just be very popular.
Because if I'm honest with you, man, like when my first couple of years building my company, I was thinking of all the bosses who told me I couldn't do it. I was thinking of the bullies. I was like, you know what? Like all the people who told me I could never do it.
Yeah.
And that fueled the hell out of me, man. And not that I'm satisfied with our growth. I'm always pushing forward, but like that FU energy, man, like I don't have it as much anymore. And I kind of miss it. I'm like, it's just such a powerful fuel. And I do find like a lot of the founders I've met that have become billionaires or done incredible things. I'm like, they were extremely isolated or ostracized when they were kids. They've got like deep wounds that they like never fully healed from, but they learned how to channel. And I think there's something to be said for that, man. It's like having those moments, but you have something to prove. I think, you know, the biggest mistakes I've made in executive hiring are hiring people with amazing logos, amazing trajectories, but they don't have the fire anymore. There's nothing to prove.
Yeah.
Right. And so like, that's an interesting concept of like, I'm super curious about, you know?
Yeah. But I don't think it's just, I agree that that's definitely one set of patterns that works, but I don't think that it's the only one.
Yeah.
So for example, Gokul, he is extremely successful, but he works just as hard as anybody I know. And he works just as hard as when I knew him 20 years ago at Google.
Mm-hmm.
He's like up late at night, up early in the morning. He's helping portfolio companies. He's like negotiating. He's like, he seriously works extremely hard.
Yeah.
I think that's just who he is.
Vinod is the same way too, right?
It's the same way. He just like will not stop working.
Yeah.
But it's not because he has something to prove. I mean, maybe Vinod wants to prove some more stuff, but I don't think he has anything to prove to anybody.
He's a legend, right? But I think you're either working out of desperation or inspiration. Yeah. And I think it's nice when
it's who you are.
It's just who you are. Yeah. You're naturally inspired by your work and you want to create more value for the world.
Yeah.
What do you think? What do you feel like is, because you've had successes in Fang, you've had successes at Kosla, now you're doing awesome stuff at Bling. Like, what do you feel like is the primary driver for you right now?
Well, I think I'm just lucky that I can do what I love to do as my profession.
Mm.
Because what I was doing as a hobby before, I get to do now as a profession. And so I think it's extremely fun and interesting. And, you know, so
if this isn't too personal, I'm curious because the man you are today, you had to evolve like crazy. You had to overcome a lot of different things to get here, right? Like, for you, what was the biggest like insecurity or shortcoming or thing you had to work on within yourself to be here today?
That's an interesting question.
Sometimes we have blind spots we didn't see, or we had a character flaw, or we just had some sort of shortcoming where we're like, man, if I don't figure out how to tackle this, I don't get to that next level, right?
I think investing is very different than in operating. I think in operating, if you get to a certain level at a large company and you don't play nice, or if you're more intent on speaking truth than getting along, then I think, you know, it becomes problematic.
You suffer.
So I think that, you know, the industry that I'm in, fortunately, unfortunately, allows my weakness to be a strength, which is that I think I just,
you speak truth.
Say what I think that it is, but be empathetic about it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I think that's absolutely one of my biggest quote unquote weaknesses. So it's interesting because my friends oftentimes like to say, like, you just say whatever you want, you don't give a shit. I'm like, well, yeah, that's kind of true. But I try not, like, so with investing, I think part of it's that you want these entrepreneurs to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we at Bling, we try to be direct and honest about it. We are not cheerleaders. We don't just say, great, great, participation trophy for you, participation trophy for you, participation trophy for you. Because that's not the way that the world actually, or the investing world actually works.
Mm-hmm.
And it only goes so far, right? So, and so I would say one of the biggest quote unquote flaws is one of my biggest strengths also, because culturally also, so I was born in Taiwan, came to the States when I was 3. And it's interesting because, you know, culturally, I feel like the United States has evolved even more toward like more PC culture.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that people, when they go to some of the Asian countries, they're like, wow, these people are brutal. Like they just call that little girl fat. But it's really interesting because in the United States, we can be like, oh, Chris, you're so tall. But you can't say, oh, you're so short.
That's right. Only when it affirms our egos and makes us feel good.
But it's not a judge. See, like there's a difference. There's a there's a statement. There's an axis, which is the statement, true or false. And then there's an axis of, is this a judgment or is it not a judgment? Mm-hmm. You can say something of like, oh, this piece of paper is white and this piece of paper is not white. But like there doesn't have to be judgment associated with
correct.
It.
Yeah, you're making an observation. It's just,
yeah.
Judgment's not inherently negative either.
Correct.
We have to make judgments all the time.
And so correct. So there's this weird aspect of like, you can call things as you see them, and it doesn't mean that you're critiquing it per se. You're
right.
Just like, this is just what it is.
But that's important, right? Like
I think it's extremely important.
Yeah.
I think in venture investing and in operating as a founder, you have to see things for what they are, even if you're selling a different vision and a dream. So like we tell the best founders know exactly what's going on, but they can paint another story, which is a Kool-Aid version of the world that they're going to lead everybody to, including their customers. But they don't drink the Kool-Aid themselves.
Interesting. That's so interesting. What do you think separates, there's the good, there's the great, there's the elite, right? Like the point, you know, the 1% from the 0.1% of investors, like what is it that separates that?
People do not like my answer on that.
I'm very curious.
I think it has a lot to do with luck.
That's it.
No, it's not it. But you can clearly, so I do believe that there's a lot of very good investors that will repeatedly return 3, 5, 7x on their funds.
Yeah.
And they're good. Like they can predictably say like this set of company, like this set of entrepreneurs, they're going to perform well. They can help the companies if that's what their value proposition is, or they can be like founders and say, you know, we'll support you when you need it. And like, you know, we won't vote against you.
Yeah.
And they'd be predictably good. Mm-hmm. But I do think there is an aspect of luck, because if you think about it, and let's just be honest for a second, the people who join Google, the people who invested in Google, the people who started Google, I don't think nobody thought we'd be a $1 trillion company.
Right.
Or $2 trillion.
There's company. Some luck there.
The markets became so large, right? So yeah. The other thing is like Facebook, which is now rebranded to Meta, like the whole mobile market that was created by Apple and Google expanded the TAM dramatically.
Right.
So now we have another $1 trillion company. I mean, if you think about it, 20 years ago, there were no $1 trillion companies. I remember having this debate with Larry, and we were talking about payment processing fees. And I said, you know, even $1 trillion companies, like there are no $1 trillion companies. And I was like, the closest Walmart, it's the same order of magnitude. And so, but that was then. Now there's lots of $1 trillion companies because the markets are so large.
Right.
So if you think about it in the return profiles, that if you're good, you get 3, 5, 7, 10, whatever, you choose the X. But I personally believe that if you are lucky, you get another 0 behind it. And if you're really lucky, you get another 0 behind it. And that's like, that just changes like everything, right? Like the whole, it's the power law of returns and just like—
Yep, the power laws. Everything. But there's something to be said for increasing your surface area of luck, right?
Yes,
like
yes,
for being sure. Very skilled at your craft, put that's, you in a position yeah, where
having
you—
Having a good reputation.
Reputation, exactly, you're in the right rooms. Like I'll be that's honest, right. Like I've been investing for 4 years. I've invested in maybe 20 early stage startups and out of my first five, two reached unicorn status.
Great.
Right. And I am not a great investor, right? I was working with the CEOs. I tagged along with Sequoia, Andreessen, Lightspeed. I had access to the right deals, and I did great work for them, improved my value to get on the cap table. Yeah. So I did create the luck in some sense there, but like part of that is just being in the right networks and being in front of the right founders at the right time. Like I am not a disciplined investor. Like I can't look at unit economics. I can look at people and say, you have something special. You like, I can just tell you can't lose. Right. So I can use the EQ element there, but I think to that point, like I could end up having a better track record than some VCs and just be a shit investor relative to their intellect. Right. So luck does come.
No, but look, so you have $1 billion company, right?
Yeah.
But what if you have $1 trillion company?
Yeah. I read
it's 1,000.
It's
1,000, right?
It's a thousand. I read that if you were
it's 1,000 X
an employee,
then the $1 billion.
Yeah, that's so even, like, that's a little bit bigger. But
that's what I'm saying. Like maybe you have a $1 trillion company, maybe you don't. So like so Vinod would say that the markets have to be large enough. And I agree with that. But the thing is, oftentimes you don't know how big the market is going to be 10 years before it becomes that. Like you didn't know the internet and mobile would be that large. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's this famous McKinsey study about, you know, mobile phones and like the penetration of mobile phones are just completely off, which is, I think Keith has tweeted it many times. He talks about how you can never trust a McKinsey study. And it's like the markets just have to be large enough. And sometimes you don't know the market's going to be that large. So as another example, you look at all these SaaS companies that are $1 billion to $10 billion companies.
Yeah.
And in the late 2000s, I think nobody thought the markets would be big enough. Salesforce, I think, was like one of the leading companies. And we're like, okay, so that's kind of like the size that these companies can get to. But you look and you have, you know, DocuSign, you have RingCentral, Okta, like you have a ton of these companies that are all multi-billion-dollar companies that a lot of people didn't think would be large enough because the market size at the time was not large enough.
We couldn't have predicted
it. Exactly. So there's so many of these that, you could predict it. Some people did predict it.
Right.
Yeah, but they,
that's
they
the
were
contrarians, right?
Yeah, they were right.
Yep.
I think conventional wisdom was that these things would not be large enough.
Mm.
And you know what? They are large enough. And so, and some of them became these consumer companies became $1 trillion companies. And if you look, then, you know, in 2004, if you were looking at Apple, which I, 1999, you're looking at Apple, like this is kind of a disaster company. Right. And so, but now, you know, the largest, I don't know whether today it's the largest company in the world or whether Nvidia is, but you know,
they're back and forth.
Not Apple, Microsoft. Microsoft also similarly, like, you know, when the era of Google, people were like, oh, Microsoft is over. Microsoft is so over. But Microsoft is not over.
Not at all.
Yeah. Microsoft is like the number one or number two company in the world.
Speaking of that, then if we're looking forward 10 years and looking at industries and markets that could be massive, do you have any like gut instincts in terms of what you think some untapped or kind of overlooked industries are in 10, 15 year timeframe?
That is highly unclear because of the advent of all of the AI innovations, that it is fundamental technology shift, which makes the market extremely unclear.
More unpredictable than ever.
Unpredictable, because like if Google gets its act together in terms of AI, it already has the front door to the internet. So in theory, it should be able to capture. But the question is, can it?
Who do you think wins the war in AI? Who do you think comes out as a dominant player?
If you look at it, there's a consumer offering that I think OpenAI and Google may do well in. And then there's the, you know, enterprise offerings, which I believe Microsoft, Google, and OpenAI should all do well in.
It's not a one person takes all market. Like there's going to be.
Well, I think it's, so if you look at, for example, the cloud services industry, it's pretty split.
AWS, GCP.
Yeah, Azure. And Microsoft is gaining share on AWS. And so continuing to gain share on AWS. But, you know, like I said, 20 years ago, people would have said, Microsoft is over. Like, what's Microsoft? Like,
it's so unpredictable.
But Microsoft is not over. And it's like, it's a dominant force in the industry.
Yeah.
And so I think it depends completely on how the companies play and how well they execute and whether they've got the people to execute or not, or whether everybody's like asleep at the wheel. It just depends.
Within the AI sector that you're investing in, you have foundation models, highly competitive. You've got consumer B2B applications, vertical use cases. Like, are there any particular subsets of AI that you think are I guess, better places to invest, maybe because either competition or because of the ability to actually pull them off? Like, are you focused on any sort of subsets in AI, or is it just strictly based on the founder and case by case?
Well, yeah, it's a combination of two things. Like, the first is the founder and how great they are.
Yeah.
And then the second is like the size of the markets. In terms of AI, in terms of all companies, we try to look for companies that have an accruing advantage, some sort of defensibility or an accruing advantage that makes them get better and better over time, which makes their product better and either their unit economics get better and or their cost of sales go down, or the cost of switching go dramatically up.
Got it. Yeah.
And so there's lots of companies for which they have proprietary models that if they have more data, they become better and better, and they have proprietary data that nobody else has. So we do look at that. We have a variety of companies that service the space, in the law space, in the finance space, so on and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. It's so exciting. Like every industry, whether it's legal with Harvey or Robin, you've got trunk tools for construction, just all these vertical use cases, is so much disruption happening. I'm curious on the other side of things, again, so unpredictable, but are you at all afraid of AI? Afraid of what it's going to do to the world?
Probably not as much as other people make
the doom and gloom people that are reading the news, like robots going to come take you out kind of thing. Like, I'm curious, I know it's so hard to predict, but in the short term, let's just call 2-3 years, what do you think are the most practical use cases and ways that AI could, you know, transform the way we live? Like,
well, I think it'd take a lot of the rote work and remove it.
Yeah.
But like, I've been investing in that space for a very long time since, like, you know, when we were at Coastal Ventures, when I was at Coastal Ventures, we would always invest in AI companies that were automating a variety of tasks that were done by humans.
Yeah. AI, so I think it's been around for a long time. It just got a lot of publicity lately, but now it's different, right? Because now we're approaching AGI, where it's like, oh shit, these things can think better than us, which I think is like, okay.
Kind of like an MBA that, like, they, you know, sometimes it's right, but sometimes it's like very wrong, but sounds very confident.
Yeah. That's a good one. I like that. So you're not so much worried about that, but it's hard to say, because, like, obviously I think it's going to create a lot of opportunities and make people more efficient and bring a lot of benefits, especially in like healthcare and a lot of industries. But like, I think it's going to wipe out a shit ton of jobs, right? It's going to make people have to retool.
But this is what everyone said about every industry.
But that's like
every technical.
That's how it always has happened, right? Like, you have horse and buggy people. They get displaced by cars. Then they get displaced by Tesla. Then Tesla might get and then the Ubers. And then now it's going to be Waymo, and self-driving cars are going to potentially displace Uber. Who knows? It's just how it goes.
The nature of what's valued in society changes over time. There was a time when spices were highly valued. They're probably, you know, all commodities now for the most part.
Mm.
But things change.
That's it. The person who wins in this world is just the person who's the most adaptable.
I agree with that, actually.
Is that a fair assessment?
Isn't that? I think that's pretty accurate, actually.
And I think that's why a lot of these bigger companies are in trouble, because, like, naturally you put up more guards.
Yeah, exactly.
You're slow to adopt innovation because you just don't want to. It's what's working is working. But like, that's
what doesn't mean it's going to be working in 5 years.
That's the hard part for people to realize. I like that. I'm curious, man, for you, are there any investment mental models that you have from investing that you've applied to your life? Like, concepts you've learned as an investor that you feel like lend themselves to, like, helping you live a higher quality life? Like, one I realized was like the compound effect, right? That comes out in life. Like, the compound effect in investing, like, oh, I got to get my habits in order and do the things that I want to be doing in 10 years. So I'm compounding to my future self. Curious if there's any concepts you have.
It's one of the things, like, choosing only people that you like and like you to work with and to keep in your life, I think is pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
But I think that a lot of people don't exercise that model, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, totally. That's a harder one.
So it's kind of like, you know, just making sure that you keep the people. I think it's as simple as that, which is that, you know, we aspire as investors to work with, you know, incredible entrepreneurs that are highly ethical, and good people. And I think that's a similar thing in my life. It's like, you know, you want to keep those people around. And if they're not those things, then I mean, there's a saying that, you know, you're like the blended average of like the five people that you spend most time with. So like, you know, make sure you choose wisely and who that set of people is.
I totally agree. And I would even extrapolate that out to like, you become your environment. So those are the people in your environment that you spend the most time with. It's the information you're consuming.
Yeah.
So if you're watching like the Kardashians and like the Real Housewives of New Jersey, you're also the sum of the freaking five shows you watch. Like you're getting programmed by everything.
Yeah.
And so is everything in your environment aligning to the person you want to be?
Yeah.
Or is it holding you back?
Yeah. I think that like the cultural, I think the quest for fame is probably one of, it's always been the case in the United States, maybe the world, but I feel like it's much worse now than it was, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
And
I think it's to our detriment.
Totally.
It's like fame for fame's sake. There was a time when people were famous for something. They were a great actor. They were good, you know, a good athlete. You know, they were a great politician, so on and so forth. But then now it's like, oh no, I'm famous because I was on a Netflix show and I was too hot.
Yeah. Well, I think that really propelled too with the creator content, right? Because you could self-create your own fame.
Yes.
And you could literally just do the dumbest shit and entertain people and get millions of followers, but you have no substance behind what you're doing. But I think as a society, we've glorified that, right?
We absolutely have.
And so we're
and there's so much money around it.
So much money in it, but we're a worshiping culture. We always have to worship something, right? And we used to, like, when we're back in the Stoics, the old days, we worshiped character. We worshiped being someone of principle, of doing great things for the world.
It's part of the decline of the church.
Right? It's that. And now we worship anyone who has attention, anyone who has followers, anyone who can get attention. We worship people that have terrible values. And that's why I think to really keep America in the position it's in, or maybe get back to where we think we are, we have to go back to character first. Like we have to prioritize our characters and great work ethic.
I agree with that, but I don't know how that happens, because I think the incentive models are pretty broken.
Yeah, you're right.
That reminds me, there was like this, you know, the overheard in LA account, which is like, what do you look for in a spouse? Oh, actually, more specifically, it was like, what do you look for in a girl?
Yeah.
And then the answer was fewer than 300 Instagram followers.
I can relate to that. Yeah. Yeah. It makes sense though. I think, cause it goes back, whether you want to be a great investor, whether you want to be a great founder, like being principled and true to your values, that's everything, right? You lose that, you're a freaking bag in the wind. You take on the wrong investors, you bring on the wrong employees. Like if you're not a valued, principled person, you lose your compass in life and you make terrible decisions.
Well, I agree with that. But I think that the tricky part of this is the influencer economy actually generates a lot of wealth for a lot of people.
It's true.
And I think you can be charismatic, good looking, controversial, and just make a lot of money. And so the monetization models there exist and they work. And we're a capitalist society. And so I think, you know, that's one of the paths that a lot of people pursue.
Yeah, it's true.
And I think, you know, the Kardashians have made a really clear template of that.
Yeah. There's a lot of different paths, but on that note too, on the values, you saw, you know, Alexander just put out his tweet on MEI, right? Yeah. Like merit, excellence, and intelligence, right? Yeah. I feel like that's how company's been built for the last hundreds of years, but it's like kind of crazy we even have to say that. But what was your take on his post about that, about only hiring people based on those values?
I agree with what he said. I don't think it's controversial.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, it was controversial to say that.
Right.
And I think, you know, there's this discussion of our VCs becoming more and more, you know, right. And to me, I'm not sure that they in fact are, because I think, you know, 20 years ago, I would have been considered far left, but I think I'm probably considered more middle. Now,
because of how
because it's just shifted.
It just shifted, right?
Yeah.
You stayed shifted. In the same spot relatively.
Relatively, yeah. Relative. I mean, I think, you know, socially, but it used to be like, you know, socially, fiscally conservative, you know, socially liberal.
Yeah.
But it was like, now it's like, it's not those, it's just not the same.
It's
like,
not the same.
It's not the same anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I don't think it's that controversial. I think I'm glad that we were able to talk about things freely again, in the sense that, you know, one of the things that within the last, like, what, 5 years or so, it was very hard for investors to say, you know, you got to work a lot, because the dominant meme was work-life balance, work-life balance. And then now, like you can say, work-life balance is a myth. If you want to be an entrepreneur, it's a myth.
Yeah.
And like, if in the way that I tell, so in that era where you could not say that work-life balance was a myth, I had to talk about it differently, PC, which is that if you're playing chess and I can move three times or two times or three times every time you make one move, well, if I'm a novice, I stand a fighting chance against a grandmaster because I can move three times every time you move once, right? So, and people are like, oh, that makes sense.
That actually is a good metaphor. I like that.
But they're like, oh no, but work-life balance.
Yeah.
But you have like this competitor, right? So
right. It's
like, if you're operating in a vacuum and there's no competition, fine.
Right.
No big deal. Take your time. But yeah. If you are operating a space that has competition, and all spaces have competition, it doesn't matter. Like Facebook had a ton of competition, Google had a ton of competition, like all of these, Apple, NVIDIA, et cetera, everyone has a ton of competition. You gotta prioritize.
Yeah.
And it's not controversial to say, you know, you can't have everything in life. You have to make decisions, and you make your set of decisions and your competitors make their set of decisions. And like, this is just how these effects compound. So I don't think Alexander's post is controversial.
Yeah.
Although, you know, people are saying, oh, you know, yeah, I mean, I've read the commentary, but I agree with him.
I'm glad you said that too. Like, and it's funny because.
But in Florida, we can say that.
We can say that. We're in a podcast in Miami, so you can say whatever the hell you want here. But I think it's interesting because.
But I also don't think I moved farther right.
No.
Because when I was far left, that was a clear, clear sort of, it was still like, you have to work really hard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, but it was okay to say that.
You're an immigrant. You're an immigrant. You got to work hard to be successful. It's the American dream. You work hard and you can succeed.
Yeah.
So.
And I got roasted for this when I put up a LinkedIn post about this, but I was like, you know, I don't think this hustle culture is toxic. My thesis was you have companies that hustle hard and you have companies that don't. They're more lifestyle businesses. It's just, we need to stop shaming people for having priorities.
But there's a difference in hustle culture versus working hard.
Yeah, and where so, you're just like, it's like hustle porn nonstop. It's just,
yeah,
it's,
well, I mean, yeah. there's this famous saying. So I don't know if it was Reed or David that said it. I think it was Reed that said it was like, networking is not working.
That's a good point.
And so there's an aspect of hustle culture, just like, oh, I'm gonna go meet this person, I'm gonna meet this person. Like, oh, and name drop. There's that hustle culture versus like, okay, I just really got to get my work done.
Totally.
And I got to do, you know, I got to deliver the next set of products. I got
to
whatever.
Because when you're a dreamer trying to change the world and you have that next level energy, if you're in a company with work-life balance, that will be toxic for you. Because you're not going to feel like you have like-minded people.
You don't
have
enough time.
You'll feel miserable, right? So it's about I think putting yourself, you can choose whatever company to work for, but realize if you want to go build a startup, you got to share a certain DNA and you got to make trade-offs.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it's okay to say that.
It's okay to say that. Just like if you choose to have a family, you have to make certain trade-offs.
Absolutely.
You know, if you're going to have three children, four children, they're going to take time. And by definition, that time that you're going to give them is time that you could have been doing something else. Maybe you could be going to the gym. Maybe you could be playing tennis. Maybe you could be doing whatever. But like, maybe you have to readjust your priorities because you've made a decision to prioritize something. And that's not a bad thing because you've decided to prioritize it. It's fine.
I totally agree.
It's so weird that it's so controversial to talk about.
I know. I'm totally with you there. It's nice to just have direct conversations and just speak truth.
It feels obvious. So.
You know, 100%. I'm curious, a few last questions for you here. A lot of like early first time investors listening, right? And they're like, okay, I would really love some tips. I want to advance my career. I want to be an awesome investor. I want to get on the Midas list. What are some tips? I'm a first time investor, early investor. What are some words of wisdom you'd want to impart to me?
Well, typically I think for early investors, I think there's maybe two patterns to follow. The first is really understanding what your comparative advantage is and why someone would take your money versus somebody else's and making sure that you have a very clear value add that's differentiated. And then if you don't have that, part of it, so that's one, but 1B could be, if you don't have a highly differentiated value proposition, you got to be likable. People have to like, to be like, I just really like this person and I want them on my cap table because like, they're going to work hard for me, whatever. You have to be likable. If you have a key, like, you know, distinct value proposition, you may or may not have to be likable. Okay. But I think if you don't have a clearly differentiated value proposition, then I think part of it is like, you know, how to win friends and people. Can you actually be likable and like get on the cap table and then build enough of these track record of like, oh, I'm invested in these like 7-10 companies that I've been doing really well. You can call any of the CEOs. So like, so that's the first thing, which is, you know, that differentiated proposition. If you don't have it, be a nice guy. Okay. And then the second thing is that if you're early, you oftentimes want to try to tag along where you can build that book, because you know there's too much, in my opinion, there's too much social proof referencing of like, oh, they're invested in these 7 companies or 10 companies, so like therefore like they must be a good investor. And so I think there's that aspect of making sure you build a good book. And so part of it's just, you know, figuring out, you know, that's also when, like, how to, you know, make friends, influence people, et cetera, on who are known as good investors and getting onto those, into those companies.
Do you think people should go become operators before they get into VC?
That's my strong opinion.
Yeah.
I think that you have a lot more, you have a lot more breadth of understanding of recruiting and hiring and also operations and strategy and M&A and et cetera, et cetera. And so that's what I did. And I absolutely would recommend it. Even so, what's interesting is when I was in grad school, I wanted to be an investor. I don't know why I wanted to be an investor, but I wanted to be an investor. I thought maybe because it was quote unquote, like, you know, cool. I don't know.
Right.
But I know that I was, when I was in grad school, I was like, that's why I want to do that. Like I was taking this MSNE class, which is this entrepreneurship class, which is joint with engineering and with the GSB. And I was like, oh, these professors are so cool. They were all like, you know, VCs that were coming in to talk about like companies that they had invested in and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But every time I talked to anybody who was sitting in one of the seats, like, oh, you should operate first. And I was like, oh, you're just saying that because like you have that seat and
yeah.
I don't.
Yeah.
And like, they, you don't want me to like, you know, like, but they're even the ones that were my sort of like same age group, I think they're right. It's just, I feel like it's much more rewarding. Like, I think people believe in the VC industry, it's like a glamorous or like high paying job. The reality is it's much easier to make a lot more money at one of these companies that's like a rocket ship. It's dramatically, dramatically more lucrative to work at a Meta in its upswing, to work at an OpenAI in its upswing, to work at a Google in its upswing. It's dramatically. The early employees are billionaires. Most, if not all of the all of them, because these $1 trillion companies, if they didn't sell 0.1% of a trillion, it's a billion.
Wow!
Right,
did 10 basis
right?
points.
Did I do that right?
Yeah, you I did that right.
Right, so, right, so.
Yeah, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. 10 basis points makes you a billionaire.
That makes you a billionaire. Yeah. If you didn't sell, and then people are like, oh, but the dilution, but you know, the dilution on these companies is very small for Google and Facebook and so on and so forth. So, so if you had like, you know, 20 basis points, you're a billionaire. But even if you were late, you still made a lot of money.
You're still okay.
If you join Facebook with a $15 billion valuation, it's still like 70x or like that.
Right.
So it's more than 70x, I think. So being VC, the people would say working in VC, it's actually like it's a good way. It takes a really, really long time to make money.
Right.
Which is true because you don't see your carry dollars until far, far later.
10 years, right?
Yeah, yeah. 7, 8, 9 years. You know, maybe in year 2 or year 3 if you're lucky and you're like one of your companies gets acquired for
quick
like acquired
acquisition, yeah.
Right. And so like, you know, if you have a YouTube like $1.6 billion acquisition at the time or like Instagram $1 billion acquisition at the time, like you see very quickly. But generally it is, you know, it is far more lucrative to be an operator and be, you know, a senior director in product with 0.3 or VP of product with 1 or 2, you know, at a couple of different companies. And then like those companies become, you know, multi-billion-dollar companies. And you have, so it's actually, because the concentration is actually higher, but you have to choose right.
You have to choose right. Yeah,
that's the key problem associated with it. You have to choose right. But oftentimes it's obvious.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And yes. So like there's times when it's like, oh, this is now obvious. Like, oh, Meta's obvious, right? Mm-hmm. At one point, Google became obvious. When Meta became obvious, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think OpenAI is kind of obvious.
Yeah.
Like you should be able to make some good money there.
Yeah.
And there's the secondary, so on and so forth. And so I do think, so this is a long way of saying, I do think operating actually allows you, one, a breadth of experience and knowledge in terms of hiring, operations, strategy, negotiating, so on and so forth. And number two is that if you've made some money, venture is a lot more tolerable and less angsty.
Mm.
One of the things that actually I see a lot of venture investors experience is angst, because there's a period of time in venture when if you have not already made money at one of these companies, or you don't come from money, which most people don't, that they're getting paid, you know, they're getting paid good dollars, to be clear. This is like, they're not low paid jobs, but they're not, oh, this person had 0.5% of Facebook.
They're not making FU money. They're seeing their peers making crazy money.
They're watching. They're like, oh, my friend from business school joined Uber and they made like $40 million. And like, I'm collecting a paycheck of whatever hundred thousands of dollars. You know, it's a good job, but it's like, there's an angst, which is like,
yeah.
I'm doing all this.
To operate.
You know, I'm hustling. Like, people say bad things about VCs, you know, like that. And then like, but it's, so I basically think that if you have operated for a while and you made some money, I think actually VC is a much more fun job because you're not angsty. You're more worried, like, at least for us, we are more worried about making sure that we are good partners to our founders and making sure that we're helping them along their success path.
Yeah.
And I think that actually makes you better at your job.
Yeah, definitely.
Because when you're angsty, like, you're like, oh, I really need this company to do well so then I can raise my next fund.
That's a
like
great point.
It becomes problematic because you can't, like, you kind of can't let go. And then if you can't let go, then you kind of too bothersome and meddlesome.
Yeah.
And so I do think there's an aspect of the, you know, if you work in industry first, one, you get better experience. Two, you're probably less angsty.
Right. You add more value to the founders.
Yeah.
You're more confident, right? And your ability to actually add value and get on the cap tables, and you're less angsty because you have a nest egg and you're not dying to get the dollars right now so you can make better long-term decisions.
That's
and,
right.
Yeah, that's great advice, man. Last question for you. Mm-hmm. Dude, you've accomplished a lot. It's super impressive, but I'm curious at the end of it all, like, what are you optimizing for in terms of your like life narrative? Like, what is the legacy? If you buy into that, what is the legacy that you really want to leave?
I think we talked about it before, which is that we're the positive value add in the ecosystem, in the sense of we are helping more entrepreneurs succeed and we are helping deliver good returns to our LPs. I think we're doing, like, I'm very happy doing what we're doing right now, keeping the fund size small and just being a positive force in the ecosystem. I mean, that's our goal.
Yeah. I appreciate your level of simplicity and not over complicating shit. You're like, this is simple. I know what I'm doing. I work out, I have my life, and just, you know, appreciate it, enjoy it, versus like just overcomplicating it all. I think it's so easy to do that. So I love that, man. This has been really fun, man. I think people are going to have a lot of great insights from this. So thanks for doing this, man.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Thanks for doing that. Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the World Class Podcast. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe across all our platforms. Hit that notification bell so you can get updates on our new episodes, and we'll see you next week.